Welcome into the BBP. This is the Bengals Beat Podcast presented by Inquirer Sports. Here, your Cincinnati.com Bengals beat writers, Paul Diener Jr. and Jim Ossarski, invite you beyond the headlines and inside Paul Brown Stadium for the scoop on all things Bengals. Find out the insider news as well as listening on conversations with players, coaches, and others relevant to the club. Remember, you can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Just search Inquirer Bengals Beat Podcast. And as always, you can listen on our free Cincinnati Inquirer Bengals app. If you don't have the app, well, I suggest rectifying that situation immediately in the App Store. Now, if you're down with BBP, let's go. All right, welcome into the latest edition of the BBP. Paul Diener Jr. and Jim Ossarski, Cincinnati.com, Cincinnati Inquirer, your Bengals beat writers. We're nearing the end of our Bengals 50 project. So far, so good, Jim. I feel it's gone pretty well.
Yeah, I think the reaction's been good, even though we have definitely stuck some forks in the eyeballs of Bengals fans with some of these. But that's, hey, when we tease this, you know, at the end of the OTAs, we said, look, you're going to get it unfiltered, unfettered from us. And I think we've done that, and the reaction's been pretty good.
Yeah, some people are fettered. I think some people are definitely, you know, that's what it is. When you have some of the history that the Bengals do, it's not all pretty.
No.
It's not all pretty, but I think it's all interesting, and that's one of the cool things I've heard a lot from fans. One of my favorite things we've heard from listeners and readers is, I didn't know that, and I found that really interesting, or I saw something through a different angle that way. I had a fan after the Corey Dillon podcast last week say, you know, I loved Corey and then I hated him when he left, and now after hearing that, I love him again. And I wasn't trying to make anybody love anybody again, but I think allowing people to see there's a new light, there's lots of new stuff, you know, you got to see the new light. They're not privy to the new information, so I think we've been able to hopefully open some eyes and some ears to the reality of history and not necessarily revised history.
Right. And you're right, Paul. I think that's been the biggest reaction. And, you know, we've talked to so many people. You know, obviously it's a little more than 50 individuals in this list, but we've talked to so many. And I'm excited for this podcast. I think all of the podcasts up to this point have been really good. The Corey Dillon stuff was just amazing last week. And, you know, not all of it could get in, right? So I think this podcast for those who have felt the same way as the people you mentioned that we do, like new things, uncovered things, or funny moments or perspectives, I think this is a great podcast because we're going to hit on some guys here and some stories that either if they haven't been told, you're going to be reminded, and maybe it's new to you, and some funny stuff too, you know.
yeah, you know, you talk to enough people and you just can't get it all in, and we can't put it all in a podcast. There's too much stuff. So what happened is we sort of cut down some of the snippets of some good stories or just funny things that were said from a lot of the people that we talked to, some of the bigger names of those that were interviewed during this process, and we're going to kind of talk you through them and run them all together. I'll run down the list of where we're going to go. So Bruce Coslett, who was a former player and coordinator and coach, was just himself on a number of great topics. And so we're going to go through some of that stuff. Sam Weish, of course, everybody knows, is an incredible interview. And so we pulled out a few bits, including the famous "you don't live in Cleveland, you live in Cincinnati" line, him talking about that. Of course, Boomer, anybody that listens to the radio or television knows how great of a storyteller he is. So we pull a little bit of the Boomer interview that didn't get out there. An interview that you did that got used but really is better, I think, just in listening to him tell it, is Lee Steinberg.
Yeah.
who was an agent, who's the agent for David Klingler, who famously said Mike Brown on television when they drafted him, Dan Wilkinson, but really even goes all the way back to USFL days. So Lee Steinberg, we'll get to that. And then Achille Smith, who you talked to, and we saw with the piece that came out last week. And then Bruce Cozzett also talking about Achille Smith and the background behind that draft, which will just make Bengals fans want to vomit. So that, and then speaking of vomit, Dave Shula will close this. Bengals fans, you know, have a tough time with that whole era. But, you know, it's just a guy we don't hear from. And I think to hear his voice, hear the passion he still has in his voice, and to hear the way he still questions the way so many things went down, just really, really interesting stuff. So that's who we're going to get to. Over the next hour, whatever this ends up being, you're going to hear some behind-the-scenes best ofs from all those people. So let's start off with Bruce Cozzett, who I mentioned. And, Jim, you talked to him, and I know your immediate takeaways were, wow, that was something.
Right. It's one of those things, we cover Marvin Lewis. I obviously came after Mike Zimmer and Jay Gruden, had the pleasure of Hugh Jackson and Paul Gunther, of course. But, wow, talk about a personality and a guy that, let it kind of all hang out, if you will.
Yes.
and fans will hear it now, man. It was something, to hear kind of it is honesty, and back when you're a coach and you're kind of in it, I read some of the stories back then, and of course you're not going to throw players or questions under the bus or really kind of let that loose when you're in the moment. So I think it's an interesting juxtaposition, some of this stuff down the line, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Where you hear some stuff and just some, hey, look, he coordinated and was a coach for those Super Bowl losses, and then obviously a head man in the darkest era, arguably, in professional sports history for any franchise. Just really good perspective, too.
Yeah. So we're going to run down a bunch of stuff here from Bruce Cozzett talking about Joe Montana, what exactly went wrong with the Bengals in the 90s, Kajana Carter, and his resigning. So here's some stuff from Bruce Cozzett.
Sam ran the offense. There's no question about it. I mean, I was his number one helper, but I mean, he ran the offense. And then a couple years later, I was made offense coordinator, and he still called most of the plays. I called a lot of the plays, but I mean, it was a co thing that we shared and did and developed the no huddle and all the stuff with Boomer, and we got along fine. I mean, we had our ups and downs. I mean, if you work with somebody that closely for that long, I mean, you're going to have some ups and downs. But I mean, we remained friends, and he's a hell of a coach, very innovative, I used to like to say that I took a lot of his ideas and made them work.
Gotcha.
Because some of his ideas were so out there that they couldn't work. They were unworkable. But I mean, for the most part, he was a brilliant offensive mind. Well, the number one reason why the Bengals fell apart?
Sure. If you have,
you want to know the number one? Yeah. They let their offensive line get old and slow.
Okay.
They didn't use a high round draft choice on our offensive line, but until they took Willie Anderson.
Okay.
You look up between when Munoz and Montoya and all those guys were there. The draft for the next 6 or 7 years, they didn't address the offensive line. They thought they could do it with low round draft choices and free agents. They thought Jim McNally was a great coach, which he is. But I mean, you have to draft some talent too.
Right.
But that was the number one reason the offensive line was in shambles. Right. Other than Achille, I think the main problem with the Bengals was the offensive line, or taking care of the responsibilities of drafting high draft choices on the offensive line. Because I mean, other than Munoz and Willie Anderson, we got Max in the third round. They let him go to the Raiders.
Yeah.
Blair Bush got old. Dave Remington got old. You know, but from Dave Remington, well, I don't remember when he was drafted, 83 or 84. I think maybe him and Milner were rookies together. Until Willie Anderson, I don't think we used a first-round draft choice on an offensive lineman. No. I may be wrong.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
But, I mean, if you look at today's draft, the general managers know what the fuck's going on. They're going to protect that quarterback.
Right.
Because there's not 32 guys in the world that can do that. There's not 32 people in the world that can play quarterback at the NFL level. There just isn't. And that's why they're paid so much, and that's why you have to protect them at all costs. Kajana, that was just, I still shake my head at that. He was so good. God, he was good. That's just a crying shame. I can still remember the play right. In the preseason when he blew it up. God. It was a hard thing to do, and it was not a spur of the moment decision when I went in and resigned.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been days where I've regretted that. But if you were there at the time, I was having health issues. We were doing poorly. I knew there was no light at the end of the tunnel with the quarterback that we had. He was just inefficient, and I couldn't operate with him. I mean, it was just, and so before things got any worse, I thought it was in everybody's best interest that I just step aside. And, you know, then that's the decision I made. And I made it with my wife and you know, it was, there were a lot of different reasons, health, psychologically. I mean, there was a lot of different reasons. I just didn't quit on the spur of the moment because I'd never quit anything before in my life. I mean, it was something that I felt was necessary at the time with all the circumstances that were going on at that time.
All right, so there is Bruce Coslett, who, if Bengals fans aren't real familiar with, that's him.
Yeah.
Personality and all. You know, I thought his take on what really went wrong with the 90s Bengals, about the refusal to draft offensive linemen after just thinking they could piece it together with late round picks,
right,
in free agents was really interesting. Because everybody points to the quarterbacks, but, you know, a part of that was the fact that David Klingler probably got David Carr before David Carr.
Right.
Sort of ruined him, where the guy saw ghosts the whole early part of his career because he couldn't drop back in the pocket.
Right, yeah. You know, and it's funny, Paul, because you look at what happened after that era and what have the Bengals done since. I mean, Willie Anderson was kind of the turning point where it was like, oh, you know, maybe we do need to draft this position. So it, you know, and going back to the team here in 2017 with Obwehi and Fisher, and, you know, Zeitler was a first rounder. I mean, Eric Steinbach was a second rounder. I mean, the team has clearly changed its position after that point in time, which I thought, was interesting, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you see a lot of first through fourth round picks on offensive linemen who became starters or Pro Bowlers or whatever. Since the end of that, you know what I mean? It's like it was sort of acknowledged. And it is interesting because you're right. It's the skill positions get a lot of attention as they should. But, you know, to kind of have him really break it down, it's like, oh, yeah, you think about it. And the Kajana Carter thing, you know, we wrote about that a couple of years ago. I mean, there was a missed block. Like, there's a reason. I mean, his foot, yes, and all that stuff, but, like, there's still some bitterness. If people want to go back and read that story and that stuff of, like, wow, the line was so bad, like, he shouldn't even have been in that position anyway. You know what I mean? So it's that's a real, you know, again, you know, like you said, Bengals fans, but at least, hey, if anything could have been learned, you could say at least they've addressed that. You know, after that point in time.
Yes. Well, and their success in the trenches has been a big reason why they went to five straight playoffs.
I mean,
was how good they were on the line on offense, and between Whitworth and Zeitler, and when Andre Smith, you know, was playing tackle when he first kind of came into his own, all those guys in bowling. I mean, and then defense, obviously, when you have Geno Atkins, that's really what those playoff teams have been built on. We can talk all we want about A.J. Green and Andy Dalton. These playoff teams were built in the trenches. And the question, you know, going forward into this next year is about, will they continue to be? I mean,
right.
I think that's going to decide whether they go back there, is whether they can rebuild the trenches or not.
Right.
But that's current day. No one cares about current day. This is all about how things got screwed up in the past. So next, the next thing I'm going to bring in, obviously, how long did you actually talk to Sam Weich?
Oh, my God. Two different conversations. I would say almost 3 hours.
Right. Sam will just talk to you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes, yes.
So to take 3 hours worth and try to even just pick a few, there's a lot going on with Sam here. So I will just say that much, that Sam had a whole lot to say. Was that one of those where you kind of get off the phone and say, I can't even believe that just happened?
Yes. Yes, it was Sam. Yeah, that was. It was almost like what caused it too. And you're like, "Holy cow! This was the head coach and offensive coordinator in the last heyday of this franchise." Yeah, Sam was. I mean, you ask him a question, and it was, you know, 7 minutes later, and three anecdotes and some. It's just it was for me, as a guy who wasn't here to cover him or to hear him on TV, radio back in the day, and also being an original Bengal. I mean, some of that stuff, you know, maybe we'll trot out at some applicable time down the line. But you know, going back to '68 was pretty amazing.
Yeah. So we pulled out just a few, because a lot of it has already ended up in print. But so we pulled out just a few stories out of it, because I think everyone loves to rehash, you don't live in Cleveland, you live in Cincinnati.
Right.
Just an all-time classic line. Maybe the most famous single sentence uttered in Bengals franchise
right.
history. Of course, you got to give Sam a chance to say that. And he has another great line that I think is better than that line that he puts in there. And then we'll talk about him from camp. And, of course, the story where I don't know anyone still to this day agrees on whether he was fired or quit, but he tells his story about the end of his reign as a head coach. So here is some of the best of Sam Weich.
Running across the field after snowballs had been thrown in there and saying, you know, if anybody sees anybody throw anything on the field, point them out. We'll get them out of here. You don't live in Cleveland, you live in Cincinnati. Well, at that, I didn't choreographed anything. I didn't know what I was going to say. I was just, the league had had an incident in Denver the week before. The commissioner sent out a memo to let this get started around the league. And we had some officials that were having a tough day, and according to our fans, and they were throwing snowballs. And I asked the ref if I could help, and he said, go do it if you can. And that's what I said. And then, FYI, I tried to mend that fence by going up and sitting in a dunking booth in March in downtown Cleveland. And Bernie Kosar and his dad, Bernie was the quarterback at that time,
right.
And Big Dog, who sits in the dog pound.
Yeah.
The guy wears that big mask. They helped me put it together with the Salvation Army's Family Crisis Center. We made $11,000 for them that day. They got a... got the booth hooked up, and it was cold. I'm just telling you, it was cold. I'm living proof that shrinkage is a reality. But I'm sitting there, and the crowd's all kind of wondering. We're in a little square, you know, a little downtown area, open area, and they're wondering what's going on. And, you know, some of them recognize who's sitting in the booth, and others don't even pay attention to who's sitting there. I think it's some kind of fundraiser. And so I start barking to get them to come on. All we had was a big dog bone, big dog, rawhide dog bones to throw, as well as footballs.
Okay.
And we'd beaten them twice that year, which was our custom, of course. And, but we had, they had not won a game that year. So my lead argument was, ye without it, talking to Bernie, now Kirk Kosar, who's going to throw the first bone. I said, ye without a win, cast the first bone. Well, apparently they don't read the Bible as much up there as I did, because it was take off on ye without sin, cast the first stone. But Bernie threw and missed with the deal maybe a couple of times with a rawhide, picked up a football in the first throw, just nailed me. I go into that water, and the water, which was supposed to be warm, had you couldn't keep it warm. It was already cold. And I got back up there. Boy, they started piling up in line. They all wanted a shot now. And the local radio station and that midday event raised $11,000 for the Salvation Army's Family Crisis Center. But, you know, we got good reviews, and we kind of mend the fence of making a comment that was meant to keep people from throwing things on the field. Obviously, I wasn't attacking Cleveland. Actually, it wasn't that obvious. It was pretty obvious that I was, from the point of view of the Cuyahoga County people. You know, we did a few other, I was always doing things. I was a practical joker. They'd have a band camp, maybe, and I'd have the marching band come just march through our stretching drill or something and just keep right on going. Never stop, never acknowledge anything. I remember I had, do you remember Brian Blados for URM? Blades was there.
I know of the name.
Okay, Blades is a big guy and went to the University of North Carolina, and we were one of the big offensive, early big offensive lines. And but Blades, you know, he was very fair skinned and in that hot sun, he would get those pink cheeks and so forth. And there were families that would spend 3 and 4 days of their vacation watching us practice at Wilmington. That was their fun vacation time. Well, one family was there that had a kid that looked exactly like Blados. I mean, to a T. Only he was probably only about maybe 7 years old. And I went over to the family and I talked to him before practice one day. And I said, you know, practice is so boring and monotonous. I want to break it up. When I give you the signal, showed him the signal, said, I want you, little Jimmy or whatever his name was, I want you to come running out on the field. Nobody will stop you. You come running out on the field yelling, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy. and number 74 was Blade's number. And I said, you run over there and grab number 74 around the leg, because his leg is big as my waist. I mean, he was a big man and strong. But this kid does it perfectly. He comes running across the field, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy. Finally, the voice overtakes my conversation with the team. I got the team all huddled up, ready to start practice. And as he gets closer, he just fights his way fine. He knew where number 74 was, and grabbed him just like I told him around the leg. And then he impromptu, I didn't tell him to do this, he said, Daddy, Daddy, please come home. Mommy misses you. I said, golly, Moses, what a perfect line. Why didn't I think of that one first? When I got, it's kind of, this is a funny story and a very unfunny moment. I'm about to get fired. And as I told you earlier in this conversation, that Paul Brown's always had a meeting with the team the day after the season ended, no matter what day it was.
Right.
Well, the day after the season ended was Christmas Eve in 19, whatever, I got fired, 1990 or something like that. It was Christmas Eve, and we were exhausted. It had been a tough year. We were really playing pretty darn good football, but we just couldn't seem to hold on to the wins at the end, and didn't have a good record. Okay, so I go in and I'm basically pleading with Mike. We're both exhausted. exhausted. I haven't even bought a present for my wife for Christmas. I promised, you know, a kid at Children's Hospital that I'd come by and see him, and then I'm going down over the Rhine for a photo op in the soup kitchen there for the homeless shelter, and which was one of my charity favorites. And can we just do this next week or, you know, in a few days, just give ourselves a chance to recover from the season? But Mike said, no, we're doing it like my dad did, and that was his choice, and so we did. So the next day I go in there, and we go in the office, and there's in Paul's office, which is now Mike's office, and Pete is sitting on my left, and Mike is sitting across the long end of the table and across from me, and then Katie, Mike's daughter, is sitting on my right, and she's taking notes of everything, from hello, how you doing, good morning, you know, the whole thing. She's writing everything down. And at one point, Mike says to Pete, hand Sam one of those cards, and this way we want you to conduct your post-game. You talk too much in post-game interviews. You tell the media too much. You give them too much gunpowder there, you know, whatever. And so the card read something like, well, we played as hard as we could this afternoon, but we look forward to next week. And that was it. And I said, Mike, this is not the way I talk. I've been here 8 years. You know, they're going to figure something's up here. And he handed me another one. It was just as short and quick and, you know, minutia. Mm-hmm. And so I said, I'll try, but I can't promise you I'm going to say this. I'll try if you think I shouldn't tell our fans, because that's who I'm really talking to through the media, tell our fans why we did certain things and how we're going to fix it and whatever. I'll try to. And at that point, I didn't say, I will definitely do it.
Right.
Apparently, that's what he was waiting to hear. And he leaned over and said, you just resigned. And I thought he was kidding. I mean, we were friends. And we still are. And I raised my hand, kind of like Johnny in the back of the room, those old jokes. And I said, excuse me, but isn't that my line? Don't I get to say that? I resigned. And he said, you just resigned. He repeated it. And I looked over at Katie and I said, Katie, write this down. I am not quitting. I have not resigned. I do not resign. And as I'm getting up, I push the chair back to stand up and reach across to shake Pete, Mike, and Katie's hand. And when I push back, the chair gets caught in the rug a little bit, and I almost fall over the back of the chair. But I grab myself in time, and I shake Pete's hand. Pete's a super guy and friend as well. Reach hard across the table, a bit longer reach, shake Mike's hand, and then shake Katie's hand. And I turn, and I go, and as I'm walking out, I guess I'm now in a little state of shock. I wasn't waiting for this one. And as I'm going, I kind of turn back to them as I reach for the doorknob, and I miss the doorknob. And normally, I am really good on the first try going for doorknobs. I rarely miss. But I turned around, I missed, I fumbled around the doorknob, and finally opened the door. And on the other side was John Murdo, who had been a business manager for the Cincinnati Reds forever. They'd come over and been a business manager for the Bengals, or in the business office with the Bengals while I was there. And he was standing there, and he started saying, I knew it. I knew something was wrong. You should never have had that meeting. I knew it. And he said, there's media all over the place outside. I said, why would they be here all over the place outside? And, you know, they didn't know what time we were having a meeting or anything, or if we were having one at all. And as we're walking down the hall, most of the secretaries had their desk kind of in the hall, wide hallway there, outside of whatever they were secretary for. And the girls started crying. They all knew, apparently, or they suspected. And so we walked down that tear drench, And then into my office, and Myrtle says, you got to go down the back way. I got my car down there. You're not going to get through the front. And so we go down the back, and John drives me around to my car, and I go to the airport. And actually, I call my, I call my wife first from the office. I don't even remember if we had cell phones then. I don't think we did. I think I called up from the office and just said, I'm no longer the coach of the Bengals. And then I call home, and my two kids were there, and Carrie answered the phone, my youngest daughter. And I said, I'm no longer the coach of the Bengals, Carrie. And she said, oh, Dad, you're kidding. And she yelled at Zach, Zach, Dad says he got fired. And thinking I was pulling a practical joke on her. And Zach yells, Carrie, come here, there are TV trucks all in the yard out here with their antennas up. And so I give her instructions on go out the back door. I don't want them having to be the spokesperson at that point. They didn't know what was going on anyway. They were just kids.
Right.
And we end up spending some time with Bob Trumpy and Pat Trumpy, who were, teammates and friends, spending time that night. And then the next day we go down to Florida to that little 900 square foot condo. And that's when Lapham calls me. He says, you got to get a hold of the Buccaneers. I think they're now here. They're looking for you.
All right. So there is the one and only Sam Weish. I got to tell you, so Jim, my favorite line, forget you don't live in Cleveland, you live in Cincinnati. I like the dunking booth in Cleveland line. Ye without a win, cast the first bone. I just love that line, and the fact of him being like, I don't think any of them were reading the Bible as much as I was. And how cold that was, and him referencing... He was the beginning of shrinkage.
Yeah, I know, right?
It's just some stuff you just can't make up, man. It's too good.
The thing I think about with and Weish and these Coslet stories is like, can you imagine these guys in today's day and age?
No. No. I mean, it would be a constant. They would need their own Twitter feed. Like, it would just, all you got was like Sam and Boomer news on
oh
one.
My
you
God.
That was the only people you would have in your one column.
Right. Unbelievable. Yeah, great stuff. And Sam, obviously, like, again, can you imagine, Marvin Lewis or, having some of the shenanigans and antics that Sam wanted to pull and do, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah. And it was, he was a wild card, and that was part of what made him great. It's part of what made his teams great. They were always out there and pushing the envelope and trying to do something different, and that was sort of him being himself. So and he ends up with the perfect fit with Boomer.
Right.
Your coach quarterback combo is so important, and you end up with two guys where, as you'll tell after we give you more Boomer stuff, who were just made for each other. Because the way they were just both so out there and just wanted to do whatever the heck they wanted to do and are okay and understand each other that way, I think.
Right.
It's common bond that way.
Right. Right. Yeah. They definitely, if people looked at the video a couple of weeks ago about the comedy club trip and the tension Sam and Boomer had after the strike that led to the 88 Super Bowl, I mean, you got a little bit of that then, their relationship, and just that. That dynamic nature, both personalities. And hey, look, man, you hear it here in this podcast, right? Yeah. You're about to hear Boomer. And, like, those guys together for in that sort of space and time is quite amazing.
Yeah, and Boomer's talked in the past about how, Sam would do things just to take pressure off of the team.
Right.
That was part of Sam's MO, is he did things when he felt like the team needed some attention taken away from him. And that was all part of the deal. And so, anyway, so I'm going to bring in some of Boomer, and he talks a little bit about some of the stuff that was going on, where you had the whole no women in the locker room thing, that from the early 90s, and there was the Victoria C sexual assault civil lawsuit. All that stuff was going on, so he kind of talks about that and just and then all of Sam's shenanigans as well. So here's some of Boomer Esiason.
But the whole one of the most unbelievable things, I want to say it was 90 or 91. I think it was 91. I think it was 91. We had a Monday night game in Seattle, and that's when Sam decided to keep the string rider from the USA Today out of the locker room.
Yes, yeah.
No women in the locker room. You remember that whole thing?
I do.
So we were 3-0 on a Monday night game, go to Seattle, we lose the game. I got beat up really bad that game. But Rufus Porter just was all over me in that game. The old Kingdom, it was hard to hear, and it was a big game for both teams. We had knocked them off the playoffs the year before, 2 years before, so they were out for revenge, and they beat us. So we go in the locker room, and I'm in the shower, and Sam goes, "Boom, I need you." I said, "Need me for what?" He goes, "I'm not letting women in the locker room. This is because of the Zeke Mowat and Lisa Olsen thing the week before in New England." And I'm like, "Sam, you got to, come on. You got to let her in the locker room. Well, let them in." I thought there was a bunch of them. He goes, "No, there's only one, and she's outside. I'm not letting them in. I'm taking a stand right now. It's just not right." And I'm like, "Sam, we fought this battle years and years and years ago. What are you doing?"
Yes.
I mean, it was crazy. You could write an article just about, you could write a book about this whole situation. So I said, "Okay." So I get dressed, and they have the hordes of people around me. Now, it's late Monday night, so everybody's got a deadline.
Right.
So everybody's waiting for me to give my statement. I said, "Guys, I can't give a statement. I got to go outside. I got to, you know, Sam's keeping this woman out of the locker room." All hell broke loose. So I'll never forget the woman's name. Her name was Denise Tom, and she was a string writer for USA Today. And an Asian, she's Asian. So I go outside, and I'm like, "Miss, I'm really sorry. I'm not part of this. I haven't given a statement to anybody. I'm coming out here to talk to you about the game. What do you need? Do you need anything?" I forget what I said to her, and then she stormed off like she should have.
Yeah.
And then she became the story.
Right.
Now, that week, we stayed in Renton, Washington for the entire week, right?
Okay.
Every female news person is descending on our Embassy Suites Hotel in Renton, Washington. And they want to just attack Sam Weiss because, right, of course, he's standing on moral high ground. Blah, 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 blah. Now, in the meantime, we have the whole Victoria C thing happening under everybody's nose, and nobody knows about it except for the guys that were, it's 13 Bengals having sex with one woman in an Embassy Suites hotel when all these other women are descending on the Bengals to get at Sam Weiss for keeping a woman out of the locker room.
Okay.
The dichotomy and the craziness around all this is amazing.
Right.
So then, all right, so Sam basically is getting called by Paul Tagliabue on a Wednesday morning because we're getting ready to practice now. We're going to go into our meetings. And Sam basically puts Tiger Johnson in charge of the team. He goes, "Okay, Tiger, you are now acting head coach." Now, Tiger was the guy that Paul Brown hired instead of Bill Walsh many years earlier.
Right.
So now Tiger's been essentially named the head coach of the Bengals while Sam leaves the meeting to go talk to Paul Tagliabue to find out if he's going to be suspended or not. And meanwhile, the night before Victoria's C thing happens, nobody knows about all of that yet. We don't find out about that until later. But Tiger Johnson gets up there and he goes, "All right, this bullshit stops now. We're going to start running a tougher team." And all, it was hilarious. 5 minutes later, Sam walks in and he looks at Tiger and he goes, "Tiger, you're fired for the second time. I'm not suspended." Because Sam just got into, and you could just write a book about Sam too as well. And somebody should, because it's crazy. Not his book, but somebody should cover, who covered him all those years. So he fires Tiger. So he goes on to, we go on to practice that whole week in Renton, Washington. We fly to L.A. We get off the buses at the hotel. And there's like 1,000 people chanting and protesting and all this other crap. Some for Sam, some against him. The game happens on Sunday. It's probably my greatest game as a Cincinnati Bengal. We throw for 490 yards or something like that, and 5 touchdowns, beat the Rams in overtime. In the locker room after the game must have been 100 women, female reporters. It was insane. And Sam received 100 or 65
towels that you wrap around your waist that have male genitalia and legs, but with a fig leaf over the junk.
I do remember that picture.
It was like a freak show. It was, because it was in L.A., it was a freak show.
Okay, so there is some Boomer Esiason and, you know, Boomer and Sam, and I mean, just those guys are absolute characters. I want to kind of churn it forward here a little bit, though. And so another this one kind of came out of nowhere of an interview that I think ended up being very entertaining. And I don't know, Jim, you couldn't have thought when you made this call that you would end up with these kind of stories.
No, I did not. I mean, I reached out to Lee Steinberg, who sort of a cold call email. I mean, he represented Achilles Smith and David Klingler and Dan Wilkinson and Kajan. I mean, he was the power broker in the 90s, and here were these holdouts, and, you know, he just was this. And I thought, you know what, he's probably got some perspective on – really, Paul, I was calling just more to ask about the quarterbacks. And when Lee – like, he was almost mid-sentence when I answered the phone, and he's like, you know – what do you want to do? Take me down a trip down Nightmare Lane? You know? So he was like ready to go from the jump. And,
yes.
You know, he's. And some of this stuff is just gold. Some stuff you would never know. I mean, it was stuff that was just him and Mike talking about. And really, he said, and this is the best way, he said, if I represented astronauts, Mike would have been the moon. He's like, we were. He said. We were, you know, the foils for one another throughout that decade, and I think people are really going to enjoy this. It's still going to drive them crazy in a lot of ways, but you're going to laugh, and, you know, also, you know, oh, yeah, by the way, Steve Young is in here too, by the way, Bengals fan, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, it's crazy.
Steve Young, Jerry Rice combo totally could have been a Bengals
yes.
combo.
Yeah.
But you know, so yeah, so this is, I mean, this stuff is just great. It's kind of insight into at that time, and you know, probably still even now to a smaller extent, negotiating with and dealing with Mike Brown. And so he opens with a story about a holdout that Bengals then defensive lineman Jason Buck was having and how that
went.
Then he talks about the negotiation with Steve Young, who was connected to the USFL. Then we get into David Klingler and the moment on ESPN when Lee Steinberg says Mike Brown, and then Dan Wilkinson also was part of it. So anyway, here's Lee Steinberg on a number of topics, all of them related to, you know, astronauts in the moon and Mike Brown. So here's you know, power broker agent Lee Steinberg.
And so at one point I took a trip back to Cincinnati to try to break the deadlock. And I walked into Mike's office and I said, I'd like to discuss, you know, Jason Buck. I've come back here. He said, well, we have nothing to discuss. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, let me put it this way. Sometimes in life you win, sometimes in life you lose, and you lose. That was the whole discussion. I mean, he wouldn't talk anymore. I laughed. You know, that was the sum total of my trip. Oh, God. Let's not forget the negotiation for Steve Young in 1984.
Okay.
In other words, the Bengals have the first pick in that year's draft. And we're dealing with the LA Express, and Mike's got the first pick, and Mike loves quarterbacks. And and Mike once famously said to me, and I'll clean this up, I'm a prostitute for quarterbacks. Meaning there was never too many, meaning he might draft one every year. he was continually trying to upgrade that position. Now, for Steve Young, this was the birth of the LX of the USFL. Right. So in 83, remember, they had signed Herschel Walker and Jim Kelly. In 84, they basically picked the NFL draft clean. Okay, they signed Mike Rozier, they signed Reggie White, signed Gary Zimmerman. I mean, just taking the better players. So Steve Young was set to be the first pick in that draft. And the L.A. Express, this was not just a signing for them, it was a signing for the league. It was to show they could get a good-looking young quarterback who was going to be the top pick of the draft in the second-largest market, which is critical for the TV contract. So we had this long night back in late March of 1984, and I'm up negotiating with Don Klosterman and the Express, and since Steve basically wanted to play in the NFL, he said, just tell him no. So every time I told Don Klosterman no, he'd come back with a new offer.
Okay.
And eventually we got to the point where it's a $42 million contract for 4 years, a chunk of which was in an annuity, but it still was like over double what any rookie ever been paid. And it was the biggest sports contract of all time.
Right.
So we're going back and forth and back and forth. Dan Rather leads the news with it. It's on headlines across the country. So we finally were negotiating all night, and I called Steve's father, and I said, well, this is the package, but moreover, you got Sid Gilman, the architect of the modern passing game, to coach him. You got John Hadle, who just coached John Elway. You got they've got a line that's as good as some NFL lines, and you're going to play right away. And Kenny Anderson was still there in Cincinnati.
Right.
And so Steve's father, LeGrand, said, we'll call up Mike Brown and just see what he says, so at least we know. So, I don't know, it was like 5 in the morning our time, but 8 at that time, and I got to Mike Brown, and I said, look, you have the first pick, so you could theoretically sign the player right now. In other words, you don't have to wait until draft day. It's your pick. So, what do you want? And he said, well, we'd love to have Steve. And then I told him the numbers. He said, the only way we pay a player like that is if we discover an oil field below spinning field. And so that was sort of that. So I had that draft plotted out, and there had been absolutely no contact between us and Cincinnati. So they were just out of the mix, and they had a good quarterback.
Right.
So it made no logical sense. It would be like, if Mahomes had been picked by Jacksonville that had Blake Bortles, okay?
Right.
But anyway, so yes, I was genuinely surprised, and so you get the moment. That draft day, we had Tommy Maddox, who was going to go in the first round, Desmond Howard, and everybody had gone to take a break because they knew that David wasn't going to get picked there. So we're in a big... We had a whole floor of a hotel, basically, a whole massive, and everybody's down getting food, going to the bathroom, the friends, the family, the reporters, everybody's off. And it's just David and I sitting there chatting, sort of alone. There's an ESPN camera there, but the 100 people who had been gathered around the TV set were all gone. So we're just sitting here, and I'm saying, okay, Cincinnati will pick here. Oh, you could go to, and then whoever the next two teams are. I said, so here are options. You can go to, you'll go, I think you got pick 6 or 7. You can go to, you'll go to whoever it was, New England, boom, 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 boom. Okay. And we're just sitting there. And
So all of a sudden, and there wasn't a phone call before the pick, okay?
Okay.
So it's one thing if the phone rings and David says, I'm getting, you know, and he says to everybody, Cincinnati, okay? It just came up on the screen before they had a chance to call. So, yeah, we were staggered. Dan Wilkinson comes up, and they have some more money. But here was the key. Dan Wilkinson went to Ohio State.
Right.
One time I was driving with Mike in his car, and, you know, I said, what do you have in the tape deck? He said, I'll let you hear. And it's Ohio State fight song and marching band. That he had in his CD thing. So, you know, he plays for Ohio State. It's some, and they needed the player immediately. That negotiation was totally smooth.
Okay.
Non-contentious, totally smooth, easy. The player was in training camp on time. One of the things we did is I thought, let's lighten this up a little bit. So Mike was famous for wearing those hats there. I don't know if he still does, but they were not Bear Bryant, but, you know, a distinctive type of hat. So we found out from the team where he shopped for the hats. And when we came to sign, Dan and I were each wearing one of his hats. And we walked in. That was a very smooth, non-contentious negotiation, and Mike agreed to, you know, a four-year contract, simply because he wanted to get it done.
So that was Lee Steinberg, who was supremely entertaining. And, you know, the story of the Jason Buck negotiation, I mean, sometimes in life you win and you lose. You lose, and that was his whole trip.
Right.
He flew all the way here for Mike to tell him, you lose, and then he turned around and went back home. I mean, you just can't beat that. You just can't beat that.
No, you can't. It's amazing. And you know, like, kind of nestled in there and all that, well, first of all, I don't think spinny oil was ever discovered anywhere on the banks. Right?
No. So,
again, another what if, right? Bill Walsh was passed over. Steve Young, you know, he didn't know oil. And, Eddie Brown over Jerry Rice. Oh, yeah. My God, right? But you know, it's funny. But in that nugget in there, Paul, I thought was interesting was, you know, Lee kind of joking, like Mike telling him, hey, I'm a prostitute for quarterbacks. And that, and that kind of explains David Klingler in a way, although, you know, last week Mike kind of put that on Dave Shula in a way, but obviously it explains a little bit another great what if and turning down 8 to 9 draft picks to draft Akili Smith in 99.
Mike has told me a story before about one of the last things his dad was telling him was not to draft Klingler. He's talked about that before, you know, and end up doing it anyway. But it's true, and it connects these two. David Klingler and Akili Smith, who you wrote about last week, are forever connected in that era as being the two what ifs and just picks that went wrong. And it stems back to this thing that the obsession with having the quarterback, and partially it was the forbidden fruit because it was the one thing they couldn't have.
Right.
It was the one thing they just couldn't get right throughout that entire decade. The same thing that the Browns are going through now, like the actual Cleveland Browns are going through now.
Right.
Which is they you know, since they've come back, they haven't been able to find the quarterback. If you can't do that, you waste years, you waste decades trying to find one. And that brings us to Akili Smith. So, you know, really, you could do a 30 for 30 about the trade that was on the table.
Right.
With Akili Smith. And some of this stuff would be in that 30 for 30 for sure. And that was, everybody knew Mike Ditka and New Orleans desperately wanted Ricky Williams. And they were pretty much offering their entire drafts, multiple ones. I mean, you can go back and put the pieces together yourself of what it ended up being with Washington and what they were offering. But it was the year of the quarterback, and the Bengals needed a quarterback, so they said, we don't want your deal. We want Akili Smith. And that's what happened.
Right.
And, it, you know, the happily ever after wouldn't be the term I would use for that one. that's the story. And so when you hear this, it drives home a little bit more of how sad everyone should be over that decision. So right. Here first is Bruce Coslett talking about himself and then quarterbacks coach Ken Anderson researching Akili Smith. And then is Akili himself talking about some of his own regrets and observations about his time. So hold on tight, buckle up, Bruce Coslett and Akili Smith.
Kenny Anderson and I worked every quarterback out in the country, from Peyton Manning to Akili Smith to Donald McNabb. I mean, there was a whole bunch of them that came out that year. And by far, Akili was at the bottom of our list.
Okay.
I can still remember the coach. I want to say his name is Mike Riley.
Yeah.
His coach in college. I can still remember Kenny Anderson and I sitting in his office, and we flat asking, why did Akili only play 1 year? Riley said, the reason is that I couldn't trust him. Well, that was a big red flag from me. And then we drafted him anyway. It just happened, you know. It worked out the way it was going to work out. And unfortunately, Mike was right. He couldn't trust him. And Akili wasn't the sharpest tack in the handbag, you know what I mean? And he had some physical skills. He was a nice, good, tall, good-looking athlete. Decent enough arm. I mean, I wouldn't say a shotgun arm, but a decent enough arm. No accuracy and no awareness. He wasn't aware of what was going on around him. And yeah, accuracy and awareness, I mean, that's the two of the trademarks of a quarterback. I mean, that's you know, if you can't handle those two things, you could have the strongest arm and the best body and, run a 4.440 and all that crap, and it doesn't count for nothing.
I think the off-the-field stuff started like my second year in the league. And I look back on it now, and I shouldn't have been going home to San Diego. I should have stayed in Cincinnati, got to know the Brown family, the Blackburn family, get to the local YMCAs in Cincinnati, go to Kentucky and work with the kids in Kentucky. That's what I should have did. But things were so bad, I was trying to run away from all the negativity and all the bad things that were going on. Well, again, you know, just the pressure of trying to turn the organization around, taking that challenge. Because, again, Lee Steinberg had told me, he said, this is probably one of the worst organizations in the NFL.
Yeah.
But back then, I felt that I can change it around. What first rounder doesn't think that they can change around an organization? You know, and to be honest with you, I bet that Mike Brown, when he lays down to sleep before he hired Marvin Lewis, I bet he has finally told himself he was doing things wrong prior to Marvin Lewis coming in there and starting to do things right. And I say that respectfully, because the Brown family has always showed me love. From Paul Brown Jr. to Katie, they always showed me love every single time. But I think now, when Marvin came in there and he started to show the Brown family how the other NFL teams are doing it, that's when the organization started to turn around.
Yeah.
And we're talking about simple stuff like playing a West Coast game. Instead of flying out there on Saturday, he flies there on Friday.
Right.
Simple stuff like having scouts. I can remember going to play Baltimore. Ken Anderson is not even at the hotel because he's out somewhere scouting. You know,
the
strength and conditioning program. Kim Ward's a great guy, but there was some better stuff that was going on at that time that other NFL teams were using. So there was a lot of little things that Mike Brown wasn't doing until Marvin Lewis got there, and now they're getting it done. It was just tough, you know. It, situation for all of us. I mean, think about this as well. Here's another component to my career in Cincinnati. In the offseason, the veterans and everybody are supposed to come back together, and we're supposed to work up together as a team to try to build the team in the offseason, build camaraderie and things of that nature. But guess what? A lot of the veterans didn't even come home. So when I was going back for my 16 weeks in the offseason, I was throwing to free agent receivers, practice squad guys, none of the veterans are there, and it was just bad. Everything was just bad at the time. Yeah. We weren't meeting in Texas to throw. We weren't meeting in Florida to throw. We weren't doing anything in the offseason as a team with the veterans.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
So, and subsequently, my career ended up suffering. And, man, thank God for Marvin Lewis. A lot of people think that I don't like the Bengals, but I do like the Bengals. And, again, I'll say it again. I thank God that Mike Brown and them gave me an opportunity to play for an organization and gave me an opportunity to chase my dreams in the NFL.
Yeah.
But it just wasn't right at that time. If Marvin Lewis was there when I came in and the Brown family had listened to him, all of his ideas and doing things the way that all the other NFL teams have been doing things, I guarantee you my career would have been different. And that's not to take no shots at Bruce Coslett or Ken Anderson and Dick LeBron, none of those guys. I'm just talking about from an organizational and a structure standpoint.
Yeah.
I believe in my heart of hearts that my career would have been different, and that's why I'm at peace with my whole Cincinnati Bengals situation.
So there is Bruce Coslett and Akili Smith. You know, Jim, I can't help but when you hear the line, by far, Akili was at the bottom of that list, and how he had no accuracy and no awareness. And Mike Riley said he didn't even trust him to be his quarterback for but 1 year. And then, of course, Bruce says, but we drafted him anyway. It's the decision that certainly haunted this organization for a long time.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, look, I give Akili credit, obviously, and you've talked to him before. Loyal BVP listeners have heard him sort of own up to this and realize his part in this. But look, hey, you don't have the problems Akili had off the field, on the field, if you're not on the team to begin with. And it is amazing to just sort of how it all kind of connects together, right? Where, you know, here's a franchise that really, if you think about it, Paul, you go from Ken Anderson to Boomer. Like, they did it right. You know what I mean? For that period, you got two MVPs, like, carrying your team for a decade or so. So you get it in a way, but, you know, when you fail and you whiff like that, it is amazing, you know, and just sort of the – and I don't know if you call this – what do you call this, this looking back? Like, you know, revisionist history, the decision was made. Everyone was a part of it. But it just kind of shows you when you miss, it's really hard to come back from. And clearly there were people there who felt, you know, they were missing before they even swung, you know.
Yeah, in that era – you couldn't miss on top five picks because they were so expensive, and you couldn't miss on quarterbacks. You certainly couldn't miss on essentially almost two, top five quarterbacks.
Yeah,
it's what kills decades. And you throw in another two nowhere number ones in Wilkinson and Kajana Carter, and there you have it. I mean, that really tells you all you need to know about everything that went wrong at that point in time. And Akili talking about how if he'd have been drafted under Marvin Lewis, it would have been different. I don't know that I'm buying that. He still was a young guy with a whole lot of problems, and I don't know how long Marvin would have tolerated.
Right.
I mean, he sat Carson Palmer for a year.
Right.
Okay. And Carson came out about as polished of a person as you can come out
right.
Of USC and able to handle a big moment. I think Akili would still be sitting on the bench waiting to get his turn
right.
If he was drafted by Marvin Lewis. I don't know how much I buy that. Well, let's wrap this up with one last one, and then we'll come back and react to it. You talked to Dave Shula. You've talked to him before, but this time was really about his time in particular, and I thought it was interesting hearing him talk some about his regrets and things like that.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, and I think time does heal a lot of wounds, and he's been more open. I think, Paul, Doc was the last person to track him down after the firing back in 96, but it's been 15 or so years. And what struck me, I think fans might hear this too, and you mentioned this earlier, was sort of the passion and the real sense of a what if in his voice. Because let's face it, I mean, it ended his career. It ended his football career. I mean, look, nowadays, how many coaches, especially at 37 years old, would have been out of the league? You know what I mean? Like, if you look at it, it's almost shocking that he never got another job. And I know people are going to smirk at that, but, I mean, the guy was an assistant for 10 years. Like, you would have think he would have been, like, a receivers coach for the next 20 years. You know what I mean? So it's really interesting to sort of hear him really get specific here about what he didn't do right, while also admitting, hey, it wasn't all me.
You can't blame it all on me. stop blaming everything on me. I'm just one man. Right. It's unbelievable. All right, so let's wrap this up with a few stories from Dave Shula talking about, you know, not blaming everything on him. And also about feeling that he got a fair shake, and any thought that there was some deep conspiracy for him to be booted for Bruce Coslett was not true. And then ending with one of his regrets. So here's Dave Shula.
I have thought about it, and when you look back, you know, I was given a great opportunity by the Browns, you know, and then you mentioned the players. You know, surely we were, as coaches, we were a big part of that process in recommending, you know, who we felt that could help us either in free agency and through the draft. And we took some shots, you know, that didn't work out. You know, the number, you go back and look at the number one picks through that time period, none of them ended up being, you know, great players. So we missed on a lot of people. And some of that is timing too, in that, you know, when we decided to take a quarterback, I think it was David Klinger we took in, I think, the 92 draft.
Yeah.
You know, when you look back at the quarterbacks that were available, or quarterbacks that got drafted, there, I don't think there are any that ended up being starters in the NFL for any length of time or accomplished anything.
Right.
So it was a matter of, you know, some of that is, you know, we didn't have the good fortune of having a strong, you know, quarterback draft that year. But, you know, we should have realized that too and not, you know, gone ahead and pulled the trigger like we did there. So,
right.
You know, so, I looked at it as, you know, I had a great opportunity. You know, the Browns couldn't have been, you know, within the framework of how they were going to do business. You know, we're very supportive. You know, we made some decisions on players that didn't quite work out, and then, you know, we didn't get as a coaching staff, we didn't get the guys that we had to perform as well as they could have, and that adds up to, you know, losing games and losing close games and unfortunate things. So, you know, it's and now, you know, I've had the benefit of 20 years of perspective, and
right.
21 years, I guess, now, and you know, you see that you know, initially, and I'm sure I said this to Doc, you know, when we talked you know, I remember after I got fired, I think they went 7-2 or something like that the rest of the year. And, you know, so then you're thinking, well, what changed? Well, you did. So it's hard not to think that you were a major cause of the problem, right? But then over a 5-year period, you know, they didn't show really much growth, if any. So, I don't think they made the playoffs in any of those years. I'm not sure if they ever got over 500. So it kind of evened out over a period of time, or I didn't feel quite as bad, you know. But so yeah, with now with, you know, like I said, with 20 years perspective, looking back on it, you realize that maybe it wasn't all me, you know. Certainly I had a role in it, but you know, you can't blame everything on me. Yeah, that's fair. You know, the way I look at it is that when Mike initially hired me, I signed a 3-year contract, and then I got an extension. I got a 2-year extension. So I think if I had not been able to get into the, you know, into the fifth year, I would have thought that maybe I got shortchanged, but I didn't. You know, I earned a contract extension. And so I felt, yeah, I do feel I was given a fair shake. And as far as all the, if you want to call them conspiracy theories or whatever, you know, I don't know what was going on there that much. I don't, my mind doesn't work that way. You know, I have a lot of respect and like, you know, the guys that, that were on our staff and, you know, there was, I could have done a better job of, as I said, holding people accountable to earn more respect. And, you know, we had I sit back and, I remember having a team, leader meeting. I don't know if it was during a season or in an off season or something. And I'm not going to get into the names of the people, but looking at those players that, you know, that were in that meeting, and they were undisputedly the leaders of the team. This was after Boomer was gone, and Anthony, you know, you know, and you look back at who was in that room, you know, not one of them turned out to be, you know, leaders, and they've had some issues off the field since then.
Right.
And that was, you know, again, I was, you know, bringing those people in, and then once, you know, there were some players that, and again, I won't get into names, but there were some players that, you know, we knew we had issues with and we held on to longer than we should have. And, you know, I should have been more forceful in saying, look, you know, in order to move this team forward, we need to, you know, build with character. And we didn't do that in certain decisions. So, and I think over the years, looking and reading at what Coach Lewis and the Browns have done, you know, in recent years with the great success they've had and the playoff run they've had, I think you look at the players they brought in and you see people of character and I think they, you know, they've learned that over the years too. You know, one example I give of, I mentioned, you know, holding guys accountable. You know, I remember, in fact, we're getting ready to play the Dolphins. And, of course, that was a big game, you know, obviously for me personally.
Right.
And always playing the Dolphins, you know, because the team and the reputation that they had, you know, was always a big game. And we're playing them. And I can't remember if it was the first year or the second year we played them. But Harold Green decided to not show up for our Saturday night, you know, meetings. And, so I, you know, I found out where he was and what he was doing, and he really didn't have, you know, he had no legitimate excuse, and so I just fined him, you know. And what I should have done was benched him for at least, you know, the first half or the whole game, and instead of just fining him. And I don't know why, that's just, I think about that as an example of how I should have been, you know, tougher and right. Held. Him and the message that would have sent, you know, because it was, I think it was a nationally televised game, and you know, that always gets the players' attention. You know, they got to explain why they weren't, you know, playing, and instead of just finding them, you know, I find them the max I could find them, but it would have been more impactful if I had benched him.
Right.
That one pans out, you know.
All right, so that is. That is the best of some of the best of all the stuff that was gathered during this Bengals 50 influential 50 series. Hope you guys have enjoyed these podcasts. There's one more coming. One more will be coming next week. It's sort of the granddaddy of them all, so to speak. I spent a ton of time over these last few months, just talking to, gathering information on the Brown family, which they are the topic 1A whenever you talk about the Bengals. So I've got a lot of background stuff there with them, discussing what it means to be a football family, the dynamic inside those walls at Paul Brown Stadium and previously at Riverfront Stadium. And so I'm excited to bring all that to you as part of a bigger package. So that's coming next week. And that will officially wrap us up, because guess what? Then it's time for us to eat some calf brain. Get some mock turtle soup, and training camp will officially be upon us.
Oh, who's excited?
I'm excited to watch you not eat mock turtle soup again.
I've never eaten it. I've tasted it. So my first one, like, I will try anything for the most part. And you know, got to be a gracious guest. So I tried it, and that was it.
Yeah. That's it, because it is bad. But you know what? You just got to embrace the process. You got
to
do.
No, because the process to make that is so gross. No, that's one I'm not embracing anything.
No. Yeah, yeah. It's not pretty. You can look it up if you want to. I don't recommend. At the end of that rainbow, though, is some orange sherbet. So you always can hope for that. So we'll have that.
That's true.
Orange sherbet at the end of the rainbow, and then we're going to be in a season mode. So training camp starts that Friday. The first practice will be that Friday. Let's see, what is it? July 28th. We'll be in a Marvin Lewis press conference, followed by a practice from 3 to 5. And we will officially be off and running. So I hope everybody is ready for that. I know we are ready for the season to get started, sort of. We could use one last vacation and then ready for the season to start, and we'll be ready to go. So anyway, it's been a pleasure bringing on. I hope you guys have enjoyed all this Bengals 50 stuff. Enjoyed gathering it and bringing it. So so we'll get out of here. One last time with Michael Jackson to take us out, and we'll talk to you next week with the Brown family podcast. So hope everyone's having a good one, and we'll talk to you later. Do you remember when we fell in love? We were young and innocent then. Do you remember how it all began? It just seemed like heaven, so I did it. Back in the fall, the